Okay, we're just coming up on 7:29, so I'm going to go ahead now and mute all. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so and remute yourself afterwards if you make a comment or question, so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the presentation being given tonight will be up on our website in PDF format, along with the audio track and the contents of the chat window. We have a bunch of stuff on the agenda for tonight. Hopefully, we'll have a little bit of time for open questions as well. So if you have some burning question or comment or something like that, keep an eye out for that at the end of the scheduled portion of our program tonight. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to take through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris, and we'll get right to it. I'm going to start off with a part two of the Rescue This Thing that I started last week. And you probably remember we talked about how to make a Windows recovery drive. And the second thing I said you should probably have in your arsenal of Rescue This was an emergency drive to fire up your disk image program if you make full disk back images so you can restore them. And to restore the operating system drive, you really need to boot from a USB because Windows doesn't like overwriting itself. So if the Windows drive were to crash, you would need this emergency drive to get you back up and running. And however, for this one, you only need a 1 gigabyte USB drive, so just about anything that you have that you can use will be useful. So I'm going to use, as an example, ESIS to do backup, mainly because that's the one I've been using on my Windows box most recently as a Windows application. And it has some little quirks, at least I thought they were quirks, in terms of doing things. And one of them is the emergency drive. So to make the emergency disk in ESIS, you go to the Tools menu here in the top right-hand corner, and that will drop down this this menu where you can pick all kinds of things. And what we want to do is create an emergency disk. And then you get this screen, which I had to look at twice to figure out what it was they wanted me to do. I thought it was going to make some kind of ISO file, but when I look at it, what it's really doing is it's saying it wants to create a CD or a DVD. But what I want to do is create a USB drive. So I need this guy over here in the middle here. I need to click on him. And then that will allow me to drop down from this menu here and pick a USB drive to write my emergency drive software to. So having chosen drive W in this case, we can say create. And then it tells us that if we create the WinPE version, the kind of light version of Windows, then it's not going to support clone and system transfer. And of course, we should upgrade, i.e. pay for a different version. I'm using the free version, so I don't care about cloning. I just want to be able to boot ESIS from my USB drive. So I'm just going to say create now. My slide will actually change. There we go. So it says off we go. It's going to take, it needs a minute and 10 seconds, and it's been running for almost 3 minutes, and it's creating the light version of Windows operating system to run this thing. And then it will tell me that, oh, you have to format the USB drive. So remember, when you create Rescue Disk, it blows away everything on the drive, I think. So that's what it's saying here. It's going to format the drive and I'm going to lose everything. So I don't care because this is going to be a one-time only Rescue Disk for ESIS. And now you notice it's been going for almost 5 minutes and there's still 2 minutes to go. So the time is obviously variable. As it goes along, it tries to figure out how long it's going to take. And eventually it'll get there. So it's written the Windows. Now it's exporting the thing to the drive. And finally, it says it's done, and it took it, what, 6.5 minutes. So that's not too bad. However, when I look at the contents of the USB drive, it doesn't look very promising. It says it's empty, which is a bit odd. So I thought, well, I'll have a look at the properties. And sure, if I look at the properties, it's actually using 612 megabytes of disk space on this USB drive. So there is something there. But my technique is to use Linux to have a look. And when I look in Linux, well, there's all kinds of stuff on this drive. There's 40 folders and all kinds of stuff. But the real trick is, I asked Chris, and Chris said, well, probably what's happened is it's got hidden system files. And usually by default, this is File Explorer now in Windows, usually by default, we've got this hide protected operating system files is checked. So if we uncheck that, and it's warning us you're going to uncheck that, we can say that's fine. And then once we do that, then we can see that, yes, indeed, we do have a whole bunch of files and folders on this rescue drive. And so we can go ahead and boot this, and that will load ESUS as an emergency rescue system. So that's how you create a bootable drive for one of the disk image programs. And they're mostly similar. You do the same kind of thing for whatever it is you're using. But I highly recommend, if you don't have a Windows rescue disk and you don't have a disk image rescue disk, and while your system is still running, that is the time to make these things before you actually need them. Okay.
Actually, before we go on, Alan, I'll have a couple of things I could say to that. Back when you first got to the point of creating the rescue disk, there are three options. The first one, which you were on, is an ISO file. So it will just create an ISO file on your system somewhere you store it. Then there's the one for the flash drive. And then the third icon is if you want to create a bootable DVD. So you do have the option of any three of those. Something else I paste it into the chat. When you get to the point of choosing a flash drive that you want to use for your rescue disk, if you're nervous at all, I recommend that you unplug all external drives from your system so that you can only select the one flash drive that you do plug in, and that way you don't accidentally reformat your backup drive or something like that.
That'll be a good idea.
Yeah. I see a question, what's the advantage of an ESUS drive versus a Windows rescue disk? The ESUS rescue disk has WinPE on it, so a stripped-down version of Windows. Windows pre-installation environment is what it stands for. And it also has the ESUS to do backup program on it. And when you boot from it, it will boot into Windows and it'll boot right into ESUS to do backup so that you can then do a recovery.
Can you get into Windows from that drive, Chris?
Well, you are in a version of Windows running from the flash drive.
Yeah, but could you do anything in Windows? Or is it just, you're just running ESUS program?
Yeah, it's just the ESUS program on there. I'm not sure that you could actually do anything else other than just let that program run. If there is anything else that's been installed on there, like Notepad or something like that, or a command prompt, you can probably get to it. I'm not sure how you run an arbitrary program from within that environment.
I don't remember seeing anything like that, so I don't think you can.
Well, it's not designed to. It's designed to go right into ESUS to do backup, but whether it's possible to actually run something if you run, you know, so if you go to Task Manager, for example, and then say run a program, potentially you could. But the environment is really designed to only run to do backup. That's its raison d'etre.
Yeah, and that's basically the difference between the two rescue disks. One is to try and fix problems in Windows, and the other one is to be able to restore ESUS disk images.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in with a question? So if we take part one from last week, we've got our rescue flash drive, and now we have another flash drive for something to write to. So when something goes wrong, and we've already looked up with my particular computer what to do during boot, like F12 or whatever, so what do we do when we have a problem? We put We put the disk in, the flash drive in from last week, and we're pushing F12. What do we do with this other thing, this bootable drive on the flash drive? How does it work when you have to use it?
This one is specifically if you're using a disk imaging program. In order for you to be able to recover, like if you have a disaster and you have to replace the hard drive or whatever, and you just want to bring back your system to the state it was in when you last ran the disk imaging software for a backup, this will allow you to recover the computer to that state.
Okay, so if you don't have a disk image, I should do that before I make my rescue disk or my emergency backup.
And you have to make the emergency backup disk using the same program that you use for disk imaging. So if you happen to use something like, there are other free disk imaging programs like Paragon Backup and Recover, and you do your backups using it, and then you would create an emergency recovery disk or flash drive using that particular software so that when you do need to recover, if you have a disaster, you boot from that particular flash drive. It has the recovery program on it, and then you can point to your backup drive and recover from a disk image that you did with that program.
Thank you.
On the other hand, if you have a problem where Windows won't boot, then the Windows repair disk will sometimes fix the boot system, for example, and in Windows. So that's why you really need two of them. Okay, moving along, Chris has got part two of his session on cleaning up disks.
Okay, and Alan is going to give me control. Okay, so this is the part two for doing disk cleanup. So a recap on this. We've talked about a number of these things before, and there's mishmash of them across Q&A for the last couple of years, I guess. We've talked about disk cleanup in various forms over the years. And I thought it good to pull it all together into one location where all of the things, my thoughts on doing disk cleanup, and I hope other people chime in with what they do for disk cleanup as well. So it was too much to cover in one Q&A session. So last week we covered off using the built-in tools in Windows, Storage and Storage Sense, and the disk cleanup utility program. And so this week we're going to cover off the rest of what I know about disk cleanup, and that'll be uninstalling used programs, moving large files elsewhere, disabling hibernation, using a couple of third-party tools to analyze data storage, using another third-party utility which can actually do cleanup, called CCleaner, and then a last-ditch sort of thing, I guess, of maybe you just upgrade your storage. So we'll go through each of these. So, uninstalling unused programs, why would you actually want to do that? Well, first off, they are going to be using up disk space. So if you're not using them, your aim is to clean up disk space to give yourself more room on presumably your C drive. That's a good thing to do. And so another reason, though, which is outside of disk cleanup, is that all programs, they probably have security vulnerabilities. They just maybe haven't been found yet. And then the question is, who's going to find them first? The publisher who can fix the problem or the bad guys who can exploit the problems? And, if the bad guys get a hold of it first before patches are applied, then your computer could be compromised. So what's the best thing to do? In both those cases, is uninstall the programs. The first one, you'll free up that disk space, and the second one, if the program isn't installed on your computer, if there's a vulnerability in it, it doesn't matter. It's not on your computer. So to do that, and this is a Windows 11 screen, but Windows 10 is very similar to it. You go to Settings, Apps, Installed Apps, you hit the meatball menu, and then you click Uninstall. And the little pop-up will give you that modifier uninstall. Just click on uninstall, follow the prompts through, and it'll remove it from your computer. So problem gone. So the next thing is to move large files to other places. So we're by and large trying to clean up space on drive C. So that's what always ends up getting cramped because we're installing, you know, the operating system, programs, updates, all kinds of things like that. And a lot of people, your data defaults being on drive C. So it's that that you're trying to clean up. So, you know, why do you want to move large files to other places? Well, by default, you typically are creating all your documents, photos, videos, everything, all the data you create, they all go on to drive C, but they don't have to clutter up drive C. And if they, there we go. So, you know, the typical location for all your files are C:, users, username, photos, C:, users, ctaylor, videos, so forth. So it's all on the C drive. So on my personal computer, I have about 500,000 photos using 1.1 terabytes of space. And so they wouldn't fit on my C drive. I've only got a 1 terabyte C drive. But even if I had a more modest collection of photos and so forth, that's a lot of photos and using up a lot of space. So I moved all my photos and I moved them to a separate drive that is larger. It's a 2 terabyte drive. It's slower. It's a spinning hard drive rather than an SSD. It's much cheaper than my drive C, which is smaller, faster, and more expensive. And I have it as a drive D, and I created a folder called data, and I have folders below that, photos, documents, and so forth for whatever my needs are. Another thing you can do is disable hibernation. So what is hibernation? By default, when you shut down a Windows computer, the current state of the computer, everything that's in memory gets written to a disk file, and then the computer gets shut down. So it does a polite shutdown of Windows. It logs the user off and, you know, shuts down the computer. And then when you start up your computer the next time, the first thing it does is it reads that contents of that file, hyperfill.sys, copies that into memory, and then all your programs, your data files, everything is back to the state it was when you first hibernated the computer. So this is normally a faster way of shutting down Windows and getting it back up and operational. It has some benefits, like you can have all your open programs exactly in the same state they were before. You don't have to reopen them and find your data files you're working on, all that sort of good stuff. But why you might want to disable hibernation? Well, hyperfill.sys can be really huge. It can be up to the size of RAM on your computer. So typically it's not the full size. On my computer, which is 32 gigs of RAM, the hyperfill.sys file is usually about 20 gigs or something like that. But they, you know, 20 gigs is very substantial. So if the C drive is a solid-state drive, another reason that you might want to get rid of hyperfill.sys is that it causes unnecessary writes, because every time you shut down, it has to write the complete contents of memory into that file, which typically can be, you know, 10 gigs, 15 gigs, whatever. And so it's causing unnecessary writes to that SSD, potentially reducing the longevity of the SSD. So you can't just delete the file. You actually have to go through a process in order to get rid of hibernation on your computer. And I have here, potentially it can take longer to start up the computer without the hibernation file, but if you're using a hard disk drive, spinning hard disk drive, that can be the case. On a solid-state drive, I don't find there's a significant difference in the speed of starting Windows with or without hibernation. So first you have to disable the hibernation itself before the file will disappear. So you click on the start button, you type in CMD, the command processor, and you'll see at the top it'll have your best match and it'll show command prompt, and you click on that and you choose run as administrator. You'll get a command prompt and then you type in powercfg.exe space slash hibernate space slash off. You press enter and it'll tell you that it's completed. You type in exit or just close the window to close the command prompt. The hyperfill.sys file will be automatically deleted by that process. And from then on, it will not try to write to that file. And so it won't be creating that huge file on your C drive. If you do decide you want to re-enable hibernation, just go back into the command prompt as administrator, type in powercfg.exe /hibernate/on, and that'll re-enable it so that you can use that feature again if you want. Okay, the next step in doing cleanup would be analyzing how data is actually being stored on your hard drive or your solid state drive, your C drive. So this will help you to understand where your storage is being used up, and potentially you can then move large groups of files and so forth to other drives or delete them if you no longer need them, things like that. And if eventually you're going to recover that space on drive C. So I'm going to talk about two programs, WinDirstat and TreeSize. I'm not going to go into any details about it. If you want them, they're both TreeSize is available as a free version, and WinDirstat is free. There are a lot of other programs that can do disk analysis. These are just two that are popular programs that are used. So here's what WinDirstat looks like. And so it'll show you file and folder lists, and it sorts it by size. So you can see the largest culprits for using up disk space are going to be at the top of the list. And as you drill down, it gives you more and more detail into specific areas on your drive. And then you have a tree map at the bottom, which shows every file or folder as a rectangle in this map. And the areas are proportional to size. So as you click on something in the tree list, it'll actually highlight where that is using up space on your drive. And you can see big chunks of things and so forth. So again, it just gives you an idea, it gives you insight into where the disk space is being used. This is TreeSize, and this is TreeSize free in particular. There is a commercial version as well that can do an awful lot more, but the free version is not bad. It can do a pretty good job of analyzing, again, how your disk space is being used up. It sorts, again, by size, or you can sort by, you know, the number of files or number of folders and so forth. So by slicing and dicing your data through this, hopefully you can get a better insight into where your disk space is being used and whether you can actually move some of these files to another location. CCleaner is one program that I use and I have used for many, many years. It stands for Crap Cleaner, is where the name first came from. And it will actually do file cleanup for you. So it'll do things like removing temporary files, system caches, other what they call unnecessary files. And it's up to you to determine whether they're really unnecessary or not. It can clean out all browser caches, so rather than having to go into each browser that you have installed on your computer and individually clean the cache out, you can do them all in one fell swoop. It does have an option for registry cleaning. Avoid this. Do not use registry cleaners. And I can maybe have a complete share at a future Q&A that talks about why you should not use registry cleaning utilities. It has startup management, and that's basically the same as Task Manager's startup apps tab. And so you can do it there just as easily. You could do it here as well. It's just exactly the same thing. It's going to call the exact same functionality. You can uninstall programs, and it's basically the same as you get from settings apps. It used to be that with CCleaner, you could actually uninstall a bunch of programs that Microsoft would not let you uninstall. For some reason, Microsoft decided that, of course, you want to have Calendar, and of course you want to have Windows Mail, even if you have no use for it, and they wouldn't let you uninstall it. But Microsoft has changed their tune lately, and I think all of the built-in applications that come with Windows are all uninstallable through settings apps if you do want to get rid of them. And then they do have a duplicate file finder where it can identify and allow you to remove duplicate files on your computer. So a real warning that's important here is that, Barb, I'm going to mute you. It can clean up an awful lot of stuff that you probably do not want to have removed. It can do things like remove last download location. It can remove desktop shortcuts. It can remove cookies, website preferences, save passwords. Now, in terms of cleaning up a computer, I seriously question a lot of that, whether anybody wants any of that done, but the program certainly allows you to do it. If you don't understand an option that they present to you for cleaning up, don't enable it. CCleaner, once you've gone through all of the options and you've said, okay, I want to clean my browser caches, I want to clean the temp directory, I want to clean up the recycle bin, all of the things that you decide, yes, these are the options that I want to do, then every time you run CCleaner, it will default to that, so you don't have to revisit them every time. You just say, yes, I want to clean up this time. It'll do all the same options you did last time. The paid version has a lot of other options that have available to it. There's a performance optimizer, driver updater, and software updater. It's three features that, well, performance optimizer I probably wouldn't care about. I've yet to see a performance optimizer that actually does things that I can't do by myself and probably better myself. But driver updater and software updater, those are features that may be of interest. And I can't speak to the efficacy of any of these features because I only go with the free version. And once again, don't use tools registry cleaning option. And I will do a Q&A on that. So here are the options that I actually choose. So I have it empty all browser caches and compact the databases. I have it remove temporary files and empty the recycle bin. I have it delete memory dumps. Memory dumps are files that they have an extension of DMP. And anytime a program crashes or Windows crashes, it'll create a dump file. The reason behind that dump file is the person who created the program that caused the crash, they could actually examine the dump file and try to figure out what it was in their program that caused the crash to happen and maybe fix the problem. Mere mortals like us, we can't make head or tails of memory dumps. They are just wasted space on your disk, and they will be there from every time you have a crash. Delete check disk file fragments I get rid of as well. I don't believe that those actually exist on NTFS volumes, which is what most of us are using. It's only on FAT32 volumes and things like that. Basically, there are areas of the disk that have been allocated to a file, but then it's not allocated to any particular file, and so they're just wasting up disk space. I have NVIDIA video cards in my computers, and whenever you install an update to NVIDIA, you end up with an install file left on your drive that is usually about 600 megabytes in size, and so I have it delete those files automatically. And I have it pop up and tell me when it can clean up significant space, usually when it gets to the point where it can clean up somewhere over a gigabyte, it will actually pop up and tell me, oh, you know, run CCleaner and you can clean up, you know, 1.2 gigabytes or something like that. So I have pop-ups so I don't have to remember to go run the program to clean up any significant amount of disk space. And the interesting thing in all about CCleaner is there's nothing it is doing that I couldn't do using other tools. Okay. But it does it with a couple of clicks rather than having to go into about three or four different programs in about five different locations and say, okay, clean up this, clean up this, clean up this. I can do it all with just one utility and a couple of clicks. So I really like CCleaner because of that.
Just before you move on, Chris, Tom's asking how often do you run CCleaner? Because sometimes the recycle bin's good to have.
Yeah, well, if the recycle bin is good to have, I would turn off the option to empty the recycle bin in CCleaner and do that manually when you see fit to clean it up. How often I run it? I usually run it when it pops up and tells me that it can clean up. And it's generally it's when it's over a gigabyte that it'll pop up, that it'll tell me it can clean up, and I'll run it at that point in time. Or sometimes shortly after that. You do have to end up closing all your browsers. With me, I have a clean up Thunderbird as well and compact the database on that. So I have to close a bunch of programs in order to run it. So I may not run it immediately when it pops up, but I will keep it in the back of my mind that whenever it's convenient for me to shut down all my browsers and Thunderbird and there's a couple of other things it wants to clean up, Google Drive and some things like that. So I have to be able to shut down a bunch of other things.
And Harvey's noting that he sometimes does analyze DMP files, and he's got a utility called WinDBG that does that.
Good on you. You're way, way more advanced than I am on that if you can analyze dump files. But part of the problem, too, is like if you can analyze a dump file, that's fine, but you still can't fix the problem. If it's a program has caused the crash, you might know what program caused the crash. I don't know that you can actually do anything about it. So might be interesting, but I've never actually tried to analyze dump files. I'm not a programmer.
Chris, I just had a question on a slide, the few before this one, when you were showing us how to do the command prompt on the Hibernate files.
Yep, okay.
And verbally twice you said Hibernate slash, and on the slide it has a space. So which is the correct?
Let me just go back to it. That one there?
So both of them, that one and the next one, you said slash Hibernate slash off, and then you said slash Hibernate slash on.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say slash off.
Okay,
it's space off.
The slide is correct.
The slide is correct, yes. That's right. Yeah, just misspeaking on it.
I didn't know you were a slasher, Chris.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes I'm thinking on to the next slide already by the time my words are coming out of my mouth, so they come out wrong. Okay, so we're up to... Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I like CCleaner mainly because of the fact that it can do it in a couple of clicks, and it'll tell me when I can clean up a significant amount of space, so I don't have to wonder about it. And I do keep track of my disk space other than that. I do have probably 500 gigabytes of space on my C drive, on my 1 terabyte C drive. So I'm not overly concerned about space or anything like that, but I do like to keep things tidy. So when it comes up and tells me that I can save a significant amount of disk space, I say, sure, why not? It'll make my backup smaller as well.
And Glenn's asking if that means that CCleaner is running automatically to be able to pop up.
Yeah. And if you don't want that, you can set it so that CCleaner doesn't run in the background, and then you just have to run it manually whenever you want it to check. And there is an analyze button, and so you bring up CCleaner, you click on analyze, it'll look at all of the options that you've chosen and tell you how much space could be cleaned up using those particular cleanup options, and then you just say go ahead and do it. So if you don't want it running in the background, yeah, that's perfectly fine. You can turn that off in the settings, Task Manager's startup tab. It'll be listed there for CCleaner. And if you don't want it running in the background, yeah, just turn it off there, and then you'll run it manually whenever you want to. Okay, the last thing on for me for doing cleanup is when you get to the point where you can't clean up anymore. So you've done everything you can, and you're still running out of space all the time. So if that's the case, well, maybe you just need more space. And so your options could be to add additional drives, and that's usually the simplest solution. One of the reasons is you could do it as an external hard drive, just plug it into a USB port, and away you go. And then you could move some of your large files to that new drive. And then anytime you're adding new files, make sure that you add them to the new drive rather than continuing to put them onto the C drive. The other one is to replace your existing drive with a larger one. So that would be if you want to upgrade your C drive. There is special software that is required to upgrade a bootable Windows C drive so that the replacement drive will be bootable. A lot of the solid-state drives you can buy nowadays, they will come with utilities, or you can download from the manufacturer a utility that will walk you through the process of actually swapping your C drive for this new, presumably bigger and certainly faster solid-state drive that you just bought. If you are going from a spinning hard drive to an SSD, it's a potential to get a really good performance boost as well as the additional space. So those are, options for you if you've done everything you can and you still have space problems. Just add more space.
And Tommy is just noting that when you do that, when you replace a hard drive, It's really cheap to buy an enclosure, a USB enclosure, and drop the old drive into that enclosure, and then you have an external USB drive.
Yeah, and even on if you're replacing a spinning hard drive, the C drive is the one that you really want to have as an SSD, because your operating system is running off it, your programs are running off of it, and things like that. That's where you really want the performance boost that comes from an SSD. So taking your old spinning hard drive and putting it into an enclosure, sticking it into a USB port, it's going to be a lot slower, but you're using it for stuff that is not being read from or written to, really frequently. So you can put up with a performance hit by going to or keeping it as a spinning hard drive. And, yeah, you just get all that extra space is available for you. No reason to throw it out. So very good idea. And that's it.
Thanks very much, Chris. We'll move along to a question that came into Suggestion Box. This person uses Gmail for messaging, and all the messages are on the Google server. So the question was, how could this individual create a local backup of all the email messages? So I have a couple of suggestions. You probably know that you can access electronic mail either using an email client, or you can use a browser, which we refer to as webmail. So in this case, the individual is clearly using webmail and going through the browser, but I use Thunderbird, and Thunderbird will let you add other accounts. So I have my Gmail account on Thunderbird as well as my regular email. And both of these systems, the webmail and the Thunderbird, will let you save the messages to a local drive, so you have a backup of everything. So Thunderbird, I actually use IMAP so that my messages are stored in different folders, which I find very convenient. And Thunderbird lets me tell it where to store my messages, and I use a local disk folder to store all my mail offline. So they're on the server, but I store them on my local hard drive. So in my case, the mail folder locally is on a dedicated data drive, like Chris's drive D. So mine is drive D when I'm looking at it on Windows, and it's called data disk when I'm looking at the same disk partition when I'm using Linux. So I have the same message base available on both. So I have I use Free File Sync on Windows to back up drive D, and I use Back in Time, which is a Linux utility, and that will back up the whole of my data drive to an external USB drive, a flash drive in this case, and because I'm storing my Thunderbird file there, my folder there, then clearly when I back up the whole of the drive, I'm also backing up the email folder. So here's the settings in Thunderbird and the message storage portion. So you notice here in the highlight, I told it to store on the local directory a Thunderbird folder on drive D. So that those are the ones that get backed up. Now, the reason I like using Thunderbird and why it's a good idea to back it up and back up a webmail system on Thunderbird is that you have the messages readily available to you. So you run Thunderbird, here are all the different folders, and you can see the contents this is my inbox, so here's a whole bunch of messages, and I've shrunk the columns down a bit so you can't actually see anybody's real email address, I don't think. And as I said, the nice thing about it is you can pick one message. I'm down here, I'm asking Chris a question about raising the hand option in Zoom. I actually couldn't find it, and Chris is telling me, well, just click on React and there'll be a pop-up there, and that's where you'll find the raise hand facility. So the reason for mentioning that is because if you want to ask a question, if you do that, if you use the raise hand, it shows a little hand in your thumbnail on the list of participants, and you jump to the top of the queue, so we can actually see that you're trying to ask a question. So one of these days we'll do a share on that. Anyway, so there's my kind of backup, if you like. If I had a backup of Gmail on a webmail system, I'd have it on Thunderbird and I could get to everything very easily. Now, the alternative is to stick with the webmail system. So one of the things you can do here is you can use the takeout utility that Google provides. So you go into, you log into your Google account, and then you go down this series of steps here to go through data and privacy, and you select mail, and then you go to the next step, which is basically to download the mail folder. So here we're choosing, we've chosen the folder, here's the data, one of 70 selected, and we're going to send the download link via email. And I'm only interested in exporting this one time. Like right now, give me a snapshot of all my Gmail messages. And so here it's going to, I choose a zip file, and 2 gigabytes, I think that's big enough, but if it isn't, then it's going to split it up into multiple files, or I could just increase the file size and have a bigger file. And then basically I say, all right, I've selected the, my email messages. I told you to send me an email. When it's ready, I can say, okay, create the export file. And off it goes. The export's in progress. It's going to take a long time, maybe. Depends how big your email message database is. But eventually, you will get an email that looks something like this. It's coming from accounts.google.com to my OPCUG address, and it's telling me that I've requested a snapshot of my Gmail, OPCUG Gmail email account. So now I can, now I've got one that says the data is ready for downloading. So I can hit this guy here, download my files, and I can save as, or save this zip file here. And in my case, it goes to this original folder. So here is the Google Takeout zip file with my email messages. So it's a zip file. So now I need to unpack it so I can double click on it. It's going to extract it to this folder. That's fine. So it's to extract. And so here's the folder, and inside the folder is something called Takeout, and inside that is something called Mail, and inside that is an mbox file, a .mbox file. Now, I happen to know that mbox files are basically just a text file. So the message headers are text, the message body is text, any attached files are text because they're encoded ASCII. So everything is one great big ASCII file, which is good, except it's not so good. It's actually very, well, it's a bit tough to navigate this guy. We're actually looking here at the top of the file, and you can basically see that we've got lots of text, and it's all headers. There's dozens and dozens of headers in this file. It's not just a simple header that you see in a normal message from Chris to Alan, subject is raise the hand, and a date maybe. This is the full-blown header. This is how the message gets from A to B and all the bits and pieces that are required to make it do that. So what we have to do is scroll down this thing, and eventually we'll find out that, well, it's being delivered to Alan, it came from Micheline, and it eventually we'll get down to some kind of message text here. And you can see that this is not the greatest way to, in my view, this is not the greatest way to back up your email. All the information is there, and you just have to dig into that ASCII file in order to find it. And if you've got an attached file, then you have to pull out the MIME encoded body of text and plug it into a MIME decoder and recreate the JPEG file or the .dot file or PDF file, whatever it was that was encoded in the first place. So there's two methods of backing up email. One is just using Thunderbird and saving it to a local file. And the other one is to use Google Takeout to download it as essentially an ASCII file.
Before you move on, Alan, I actually just went to Perplexity and I asked, how do I read an mbox file? And it's interesting, actually, Mozilla Thunderbird, you can actually just do a file open, and you can open an mbox file directly. There are third-party utilities apparently as well that can view mbox files. So that gobbledygook you're facing, you probably have ways of dealing with that a little bit easier than just reading that.
You need a third-party program, a bit like Thunderbird.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But there are some other ones. There's Mbox Viewer for Windows and Mac, online Mbox Viewers. So there are some other options for reading that file.
Yeah, I see Tom here in the chat is noticing that Outlook can import Mbox files as well.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
There are ways around it.
Yeah.
Okay, another question that came in is for Chris.
Yeah, so the question came in from Ollie. Windows 11 had been offering an update for quite a while to go to 24H2. And so she was wondering if there's any reason why she should or shouldn't accept that update. And just as an aside, I wanted a graphic for this slide. So I thought, why not ask AI to generate something for this slide to make it more attractive? So I asked, draw a color pencil sketch of Windows logo. Balanced on top of it is a series of large blocks spelling out 24H2, and the blocks are breaking the Windows logo with cracks showing in the logo. And I did this through a number of different AI programs that can generate graphics from text. And this is what I got. And so maybe we have a lot less to fear about AI than I had previously thought. Not terribly good representations of that prompt. So moving on. So in terms of whether it's good or bad or anything like that, as with all things computer related, the correct answer is that depends. And so there are a number of online sources that have been indicating issues with an unusually large number of users who have moved to 24H2. And a lot of the online pundits and that are saying that this is not a minor upgrade. It's almost like a new version of Windows. There are so many massive changes that have happened under the hood on this particular update. And I'll paste into the chat in a second. I'll paste in the chat that particular URL as well. So I did the update on my computer, and I did have one weird effect, and that effect is with me still to this day. I updated a couple of months ago, and the Settings app, for some reason, it takes about 10 to 15 seconds for it to open up. Other than that, I haven't noticed any bad things on it, but very strange. I sort of thought that might have gotten fixed in the monthly updates, but not so far. So that's a weird thing that I've had happen to me. Some sources indicate that Microsoft is going to start forcing 24H2 on people. It will not just be a prompt, do you want it, or we have this for you, please install it. They're actually going to force it. That's just rumors at this point in time. So you might not have a choice. I don't know anything that's really compelling about 24H2. There's very little from a user point of view that you would actually notice. I think there are a lot of things under the hoods that has changed, but my personal opinion on it right now is probably best to just avoid 24H2 until such time as Microsoft forces it on you. Most people are not having a problem with it, but it's up to you, I guess is what it really comes down to.
What I see. Tom's asking whether recall is present in 24H2.
I didn't think it was in it yet, but I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure it isn't, actually. It's in the preview builds that Windows Insiders, some of the Windows Insiders have. I don't think it's in 24H2, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Tristan says it does, but it can be disabled.
Oh, okay. I should look and see, because if it's turned on by default, I do not want it on. I thought recall actually required that you have a certain functionality. What is it? What's the new format of Windows? The AI built-in Windows?
Well, don't you need Windows.old to do that?
And there's Copilot, too.
Copilot, yeah. I thought that recall actually required a Copilot PC, but I'm not sure on that either. I'll try and look into that a little bit for next week.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Okay, next up we have a guy who's ahead of his time here. Jeff sent this in a few days ago, and it was on the CTV News tonight, I noticed. Okay, Jeff, I think you're going to talk to this slide if you unmute your mic.
Yeah, what it was I was reading an article online about it was alluding to these checks that are being sent out by the Ontario government and how perhaps it was related to the timing of an election call. And the article was interesting, but went on to say, if you want to see the status of these payments, to use the Service Ontario portal. Now, I wasn't interested in checking on the status of the check, but I wondered, what is the Service Ontario portal? Something I had never heard of. So I went to the beauty of electronic news is the links are live, so you don't have to type anything in. So I went to the website, and what I found out was they have this system in place where you can actually access quite a few things. You can renew your driver's license. You can renew your license plates. You can renew your health card or your children's health card or an Ontario photo ID card. The renewal process is kind of interesting because it has to be within 90 days. So if it's over 90 days, you can't renew. But if it's within the 90-day window, apparently you can renew most of these documents if they don't require a photo. And it seems to be that as long as the photo is 5 years, you're okay. You can you don't need a new photo. I spoke to a rep at Service Ontario. She said she believed the driver's license was a little longer. I don't know because I've just stumbled upon this. It also has a notification, and this is, I think, really handy, the elimination of the stickers on the license plate. Every time you get in the car, I'm left wondering, do those plates expire? Is it this year? Is it next year? I don't feel like getting the ownership out to remember. And did I remember to put something in the calendar? Anyway, this service portal, if you sign up for notifications, it'll let you know 30 days and 60 days via SMS text or email or, I believe, telephone call with a pre-recorded message. So I think that can be pretty handy. The final thing was there may be other services to come. I did ask about the Ontario outdoor card for people who fish or hunt, if that there was any plans for that. The answer I got was rather vague. We're looking into it. So whatever that might happen to mean. So there you go. There's the Service Ontario portal. I don't know how long it's been up. As I say, I just stumbled onto it the other day.
It's actually been around for years.
Really? First I've ever. Have you used it, Chris?
Yeah, I've been getting I did sign up for the renewal notices on licenses, yeah. and that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very handy. I've been using it a lot too because I don't remember. I don't want to have to check my license all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had no idea. I had no idea they existed. I guess I was old school, the health card.
Saves you lining up at the centers for sure.
Yeah, well, we do it up at the country, and they have a Service Ontario in a little village in Flinton that shares space with the post office, and there's never a lineup, and they're open Saturdays, so we tend to go there.
Yeah, I believe the vehicle license plates now are automatically renewed unless you have outstanding fines. But I don't think that applies to driver's licenses, etc. So it might be useful for that. Glenn's asking, do they allow access after expiration? Do you know that?
I would think they would after they've, yes, I would certainly, because all of these items are listed as products on there. Yeah, they're all listed as products when you log in, and the login is two-factor authentication as well. So I think it's fairly good that way.
And I just noticed here earlier on that Steve Parker notes that GRC's in control will prevent auto updates. So that's some kind of utility which will do that for you. Okay, thanks very much, Jeff. Chris, Microsoft Accounts.
Yeah, so this is something I just came across very recently. And it's interesting, Microsoft is going to change some things about staying signed in. So when you go to sign into a Microsoft property, such as Outlook.com or something like that, you always get this thing saying, asking you if you want to stay signed in. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It means that if you come back a couple of hours later, you don't have to re-log on. So it can be a good thing. Near as I can tell, and this seems to be, there's a lot of variance in this, stay signed in will allow different sessions for durations that do vary depending on a number of things. The token can last up to 90 days long, where you won't be prompted to log in again, but there are a number of factors that are going to come into play as to whether you will get prompted at some point to log in again. And certainly, if you change your password or you authentication token is invalidated for any reason, you will get prompted to log in again. So think about what is happening if you do say stay signed in, if you're using a friend's computer or if you're at a public computer somewhere. You're at the Ottawa Public Library computer and you log in and you say stay signed in. You close the browser and you leave. And then the next person to come along and use the computer, they can access your Microsoft services, including things like Outlook.com or the Microsoft Store or whatever. So that is not a good thing. So they're actually changing things, and this is not for the better, I think. So they're no longer going to allow stay signed in. Are they doing it for security reasons? Nope. Are they going to always force it to be stay signed in order to be convenient for you? Yep, that's what they're doing. So they're changing the sign-in experience so that users will no longer see the option to stay signed in, and they will stay signed in. So if you were using another computer that is not yours, realize that once you sign into a Microsoft service, that you will remain signed in on that computer, even once you close the browser. So you have to be much more careful about using devices that you don't own. So you'll stay in signed in automatically unless you specifically sign out, or if you happen to use private browsing, where private browsing will automatically prevent things like history and cookies and other things like that from being saved on the device, including the automatic login function for it. So what should you do? If you are using someone else's computer after this kicks in, be sure that when you're done, you just don't close the browser. You go and do a sign out. So how do you do that? You click on the profile icon in the top right-hand corner. You choose sign out. If you don't do that, even closing the browser, and depending on circumstances, even rebooting the computer, the person going into that browser and going back to that service site, whether it's Outlook.com or whatever, they will be automatically signed back into your account. So I would actually consider doing likewise even if it's on your own computer, because this idea that automatically signing in and keeping that authentication active for up to 90 days, it might be something you want to rethink how you actually do it. So it would prevent others who have access to your computer from being able to access your Microsoft services. Now, I will say that this is not actually unique to Microsoft that they have this function where you can stay signed in. What is unique to Microsoft is they're not giving you the option. They are going to be changing it so that they will automatically make it so that you are signed in to it and you don't have to sign in again when you come back the next day. So something to think about.
So Steve's asking, if you clear the cache, does that sign you out?
No, cache wouldn't do it. There are probably some things that you could do that would, like clearing cookies might do it. I'm not sure where the authentication tokens are being saved. They could potentially be saved as a cookie, but I don't know. It wouldn't be part of the cache, I wouldn't think. It would probably be, it might be in the saved passwords. So if you go into any browser, you can clear out saved passwords. It's probably in there, but I'm not actually 100% sure. So I think just everybody should be in the habit of making sure you sign out when you're done with your email or any other service that you're using from Microsoft that requires a sign-in, and just make sure you do a sign-out.
Thanks, Chris. Just going back to this accessing online after expiration thing, Tristan says, yes, you can still renew online after expiration. Don't ask me how I know.
Oh, no. That sounds like it was not a good story.
Okay, final thing we have just quickly is a question came in, how does OneDrive work? And this individual has Windows 11 and Microsoft 365 and thinks everything's being stored on OneDrive, but isn't very sure. Now, one of the questions here was, if you sync to folders in the cloud, so you're using OneDrive as a backup, is it necessary to back up also to an external hard drive? I would say yes. You never know about these cloud providers, whether they're going to be there forever, and you shouldn't just have one backup anyway. So that's certainly a yes in my book. And then the other thing was symbols and that kind of stuff. So one of the things I found was Leo Notebaum, this Ask Leo series on YouTube. He has some really good videos. And he has a whole series on OneDrive. And this one is called Managing Files on Your PC and in the Cloud. And he basically gives a really good explanation of how OneDrive basically works when you're synchronizing a local folder to a folder in the cloud. But the question I had, which I actually posted in the user forum, was if anybody's using OneDrive and knows how it works, could you give us a share? And we have a volunteer. Jeff Dubois is going to put something together for us, and we'll have that maybe next week or certainly in the near future. Okay, we've had a lot of questions, a lot of discussion as we've gone along, so we've eaten up the last 10 as we've gone along, I'm afraid.
As we always do, it seems.
As we always do, right. What amazing. I always think we're not even have enough material, and we always do. Okay, so I'm going to go straight to the wrap-up slides. If you're not a member of the Computer Club right now, we have a special offer for you. You send us $20 for your membership for $25.26. We will give you a second year's membership absolutely free. So the 26-27 period is also going to be covered. So you're getting 2 years membership for the price of an annual 1 year membership. However, if you're already a PC User Group member, don't send us money. You don't need the money. The board has already decided to extend everybody's membership expiry date by an extra year, and we are not going to charge any renewal fees this year. As you know, we have a program with the Ottawa Public Library. And Chris and Linda are both giving presentations in the near future. And Chris, in fact, tomorrow is giving a session on keeping passwords safe. And on Saturday, Linda's doing organizing your photos. And then if you want to know all about backup systems and why you need that rescue disk we were talking about, February the 4th, Chris is doing his backup presentation. Can't get enough of Chris because next month, the February regular meeting, February the 12th, Chris is going to be telling us all about how to buy a PC, including those newfangled Copilot PCs, which is new in the presentation this time around. The March meeting is going to be a kind of members' favorites. It's going to be a smartphone apps, hopefully. And I've not got a ton of people coming forward wanting to talk about their favorite app. In fact, right now I have two people, so we're going to talk about maybe two apps. So if you want to talk about your favorite app, send the information to suggestion box and we'll put together a presentation. Otherwise, we're going to have to tweak the program a bit and do something slightly different. Anyway, that's the regular meetings in February and March. But the next meeting is next Wednesday, which is February the 5th. It will be a regular Q&A session, just like tonight. So if you have questions that we didn't get to, you have follow-ups on the things we've talked about, or you have topics that you would like to share with all your colleagues and friends, and tell us all about it, and we'll put together a good program for February the 5th. In the meantime, I hope everybody enjoyed tonight. That's it for me, and we'll see you on next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.